Today's show is a bit different. I am sharing excerpts from an interview with Rob Mokoreka, who is known for Shotbro, the story of how he wanted to end his life back in 2009. I spent the morning with Rob recently and would love to share you some nuggets from that time together. Welcome to the show. Today I've got Rob Mokoreka with me today, and what an honour it is to have you with us, Rob. I've been following your journey and your recent documentary, and I came to see your show back in New Plymouth last year. And yeah, just to have this time to talk about whatever comes up is just, as I say, an absolute honour and awesome. So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me and thank you for having me. So I feel like I'm really looking forward to meeting you in person, other than virtually.
Yeah, absolutely. We're definitely going to be making that happen very soon. Rob, I think probably the best place to start is sharing some of your story. There will be people that have obviously been to the show and are now watching this. Obviously, people may well have heard it on the news back at the time. But yeah, I think it's really important that we go there first. So are you able to share a bit around that?
About the show and why I made it?
I think probably, I guess it ties in absolutely. What was going on for you around 2009, let's put it that way.
Well, let's just say I was having a very public mental and spiritual breakdown where I was in the storm of suicidal ideation and thought life was not worth living. And I provoked the police to shoot me dead. I scared them enough that they shot me at close range with a bullet in the chest. And I am very blessed to be alive now. And since when that bullet hit, it actually, not surprisingly, it just burst the bubble of this mist that I was in. And I was in the stark reality of now my body is physically in trauma.
Wow. Yeah.
I knew I'd made a terrible mistake as soon as the bullet hit me and I fell on the road like a sack of potatoes.
Are you able to share what sort of led up to that point? Was it sort of struggles months on, or was it quite a quick decision? I know it varies for different people.
I've had depression for a long time. And the doctor said after what happened is like, you've got undiagnosed depression. But what it actually was, it was unresolved trauma.
Okay.
So I'm interested in how people are diagnosing other people. As I go, what is it really? Let's find out what the layers are. So I'd had most of my life, I've been in and out of depression probably since 10, okay, that I remember clearly. But I didn't have any tools. I had zero tools on my tool belt to do with dealing with emotional distress or emotional trauma. And so the lead up to that one, 2009, was another emotional breakup from a relationship.
Okay.
Yeah. Triggered again. So that's the surface stuff. And so historically, I just had to go back to what happened previously and follow that rabbit warren down to what the core of it is. And it takes a long time. Sometimes you think it's one thing, but it actually opens up another door, a side door, and you go, what's that? Oh, that's scary. Oh, my God. And so it's just been a lot of unpacking, crying, laughing. I've had therapy and now Shotbro, Confessions of a Depressed Bullet, is also another form of therapy for me.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can imagine that it is knowing. And I think that's a beautiful part of our journey when we get to a point that we can actually share our story in whatever form that is, whether it's a performance like yours or in written word or through an interview or just in a conversation with one person, I feel that is absolutely part of the healing and, you know, such a gift that we can give someone else that may be going through something similar or know of someone that is struggling. Absolutely. And so you mentioned then about your childhood. Were there specific events that happened that sort of triggered stuff and maybe, you know, started to suppress some of that trauma in your body, or
yep,
are you able to talk about sort of some of those times?
Yeah, So as a kid, because my dad was an ex-Vietnam War veteran, he was still in the army for quite a long time, about 17 to 18 years. So we're constantly moving a lot. So it's like my platform or at school, my foundation's always being moved or shifted. So as a kid, you're wanting stability. So I was always nervous and scared. And I've said in a pre-interview for my documentary, I was also using humor and sports with the quick ins at new schools.
Okay.
To get in with the cool kids, because I wanted to be accepted as anyone wants to. But all of that sort of moving a lot, and also probably in the last 3 years, when I'm doing ShopRo, another thing came out, which I mentioned in the documentary, I had memories of being molested. And the way that my brain was compartmentalizing it was saying, these aren't your memories. You must be holding them for someone else. That's how I was dealing. Right. I was like, wow, am I? Well, whose are they? That's how I was literally thinking, well, how do I hold these memories? Am I holding them for someone? And a friend said, maybe you're opening up from doing the ShopRo show, you're opening up other doors. And so thanks to Mike King, who offered me his shrink at the time. And he said, do you want a free session or sessions with my shrink? And I said, yes, please. And it was really great. Not that he solved my problems. It was just a safe space to air out stuff in front of someone who I wasn't related to.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, that sort of opportunity to feel heard. And often we don't actually need it to be fixed or for people to come up with solutions at the time there and then, but actually just to start to express some of the stuff that we're going through or some of the thoughts or, as you say, some of these things that are traumas that are coming up for you, that must have just felt such a relief to be in that safe place and not feel crazy or, you know, yeah, whatever the other things that thoughts that go through our head when we've got all that stuff going on. That must have just felt such a relief for you at that first point.
It was strange, to be honest, because I'd seen a lot of shrinks before that.
Okay.
So it'd been a long, sort of like a long break in between therapy sessions, years. And so I was really brave. I was like, yeah, that sounds great, Mike. I'll take that offer. And as I was driving there, I'm like, man, I do this thing. I'm going around talking about my stuff. As I pulled up to the office of the therapist, I started to start, the fear started coming up and I was like, what's going on here? And I was walking up the steps and it was starting to rise. I went, oh, not so brave now. So that was interesting, just reminiscing on that from being brave from the phone call to driving, because, and then go, oh, maybe this is going to open up something that's scaring me.
Yeah, so absolutely. And I think, you know, it is those first steps. And I know you said you had some help before, but those first steps to either meeting a new therapist or even reaching out for help, you know, whether it's an inquiry or, connecting with someone or asking a friend, you know, those first steps, I believe, are some of the hardest hurdles to get over. So I'm not surprised that, that came up for you all over again. Going back to what you talked about in terms of more recently when doing the show and more stuff coming up, and I think you talked about the black door or a door that had all this stuff behind it, and I believe that, you know, that's our body's way of coping at the time, you know, in terms of, let's just, as you say, put this somewhere, compartmentalize it, we haven't got the tools and understandings to deal with it right now, let's do what we can. And I imagine that going through school life and, as you say, different places, and that, would you feel it was a mask of sort of humor and sport that you put on, as you say, to fit in and belong?
I just wanted to belong.
Yeah.
Look, everybody is looking for connection.
Yeah.
And in all sorts of forms, and belonging is big. So I was just glad I had those skills, that I was pretty good at sport, that I was funny, but it was a mask.
Yeah.
Because it was like, please like me, please like me, please. And all of that. But it worked.
Yeah, it got you through those times, absolutely. And so when did you actually start getting some tools and things around for your tool belt, as you call it?
Being shot in hospital with my guts cut wide open and my my first session in the hospital was with the hospital psychologist. And she was there so saying, what you have is normal. What you did isn't so normal. Some lines, but what you did, I was like, what do I have? She goes, you have depression. And yeah. People with depression have a lot of suicidal thoughts. And I was like the guy, like John Kirwan. Am I like John Kirwan? But I kind of knew that because when I'd see those John Kirwan ads long time ago, part of me was going like this, shut your mouth, John. Shut your mouth. There was a voice saying, shut up. Don't talk about it.
Because you didn't want to go there.
That's right. And also from society and probably from friends and family, you don't talk about those things because that's a weakness. But you imagine this, like that commercial was triggering me and my brain's going, oh, shut up, John. What if somebody hears you? Basically, what if someone hears me?
Yeah. What would you say would be something that... what would have helped in the lead up to that day where you decided that this was it and you were going to get the police to shoot you? How could someone have intervened, or is there any way at that point that something could have helped?
Now that I've got this knowledge, I've made ShopBro to reach out for people who were like me in 2009. The first one is just to let the person know you're not crazy. And I love you, bro. I love you, sis. And I'm going to sit with you until the storm is over. And just hearing those words, you're like, can you see me? Because people think when they're in that storm, no one can see them because they're used to wearing the mask so often. So when you actually reach through and touch somebody on the shoulder or on the arm, I see you. It looks like you're hurting. And the first defense is usually, no, I'm not. And then you see people start crying. And I'm doing this. You know, sometimes I've had to do this for some other people. So I see you. And they freak out that you can actually see them, even though they're there physically, but yeah. See through the mist of that facade. So, yeah, just letting that person know that you love them and you can see they're hurting and you're going to sit with them. And they go, what, with me? Because that person at that point in time thinks they're worth nothing. And we all want to know that we're loved and somebody actually gives a shit.
Absolutely. And I think it's, again, a common myth, and, you know, do correct me, Rob, at any point if anything I say is either a myth or not true or whatever it is. You know, it's a subject that I'm so passionate about, but always learning, just like everybody else. There is a myth that people that want to end their lives are selfish. And they're not thinking about anybody else and the repercussions and all the rest of it. I remember from your documentary that you talked about, actually you felt that everyone would be better off if you ended your life. Do you feel that that's a common feeling amongst people in that situation?
Yep, definitely. That's why they're there. Yeah. Apart from having zero tools, and feeling that sense of worthlessness, they're at rock bottom. And they're just waiting for somebody. They're like, I read something, and I'm really always looking for little catchphrases, that thing that resonates with me. And it's like, they don't really want to die. They just want to stop the pain. And there's a police officer, a very famous one, who saved a lot of lives on the San Francisco Bridge.
Okay.
And one of the key things that he heard from people jumping was, oh no. And I related to that when I watched a clip of him speaking. I related to that. Because if you watch the documentary, you can see me on the ground yelling out, sorry.
Yes.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to myself who fell, who took the bullet. I'm sorry for the police officer. I'm sorry for everything. Everything in my life. So you don't know, because sometimes it's one thing and then you pile all these other things on top of it and it's hard to find what the core is, and you're blaming the surface because that's all you can deal with at that time.
Yeah. Oh, that story just got to me there about the bridge.
Yes.
Okay. I believe you said that just before this time in 2009, you had a relationship breakup. And my understanding that For men, women are a protective factor against suicide. And for women, children are a protective factor to stop them from ending their lives. Do you find that from the people that you're talking to? I imagine that you have a lot of men that are able to start opening up to you either at the show or get in touch. Do you find that relationship breakups is maybe a number one or a high cause of males wanting to end their life?
Yeah. I'm not sure if it's a high, it's right up there.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, I'm not doing stats. I'm not researching all of that. But the conversation is a lot up there, and self-worth and expectations. If you're a male, it's already the societal unsaid, unwritten thing that goes, you're the man, you do this, you do that, and that's it. And if you fail, you're nothing. You're absolutely nothing. And so as the male, you're the protector. You're supposed to be the breadwinner. I mean, in a traditional sense.
Yeah, provider, yeah.
Provider, all of that. And if you don't do that, you are nothing. You are worthless. And it's sort of been drilled into us. And so a lot of males feel ashamed to tell their wives, like, I'm feeling vulnerable. Shit, my job's on the line. You don't want to say that because you're supposed to be like the pillar. And it also... just to share this, is my observation is sometimes the woman has to unlearn the patterns of what she thinks her response should be. Instead of like, you know, you're supposed to hold this family together, pull yourself together. Some men and women do that to each other. And I realize now that's out of fear because they have zero tools on their tool belt of how to emotionally navigate that river. So some people say some very unhelpful, dumb things when they're arguing because they don't have the tools.
And so what do you feel would be some helpful responses? You know, say a guy's come home from work and maybe there's some upset at work. As you say, maybe the job is on the line. Maybe actually he's just, as you mentioned, actually some of that stuff from childhood or previously is actually starting to come up for whatever reason. How do you feel people could start some of those conversations from a much more understanding, open place?
Oh, all right, man, it's a big thing. Just go, hey, I'm falling apart. I don't know what to do. I'm scared. And you'll notice... I've noticed that it can come across as anger.
Okay.
Because if they're not telling you what the truth is, it's like, you did this, the kids did that, and vice versa, the mum or the dad, whatever stress they're under. And therefore, you don't know how to process what's going on, so you put it on other people. And it gets confusing and scary, so it's just go, man, what's wrong with you? And sometimes I've been in this person a long time ago. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm freaking out and I don't have the answers. And I was like, oh, sweet. Why don't you tell me? And I was like, because I didn't want to be a failure.
Yeah.
And there's all those fears. And it's just trying to unpack that. You know, I'm talking to such a diverse group of people from different religions, cultures, genders, and it's really refreshing to, not refreshing to hear that they're hurting, but refreshing to hear that we're not alone and we're all trying to find out positive solutions.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, refreshing that some of those conversations are actually happening.
Yes.
And I think that's, you know, that's absolutely key. And again, from the documentary recently, just the different excerpts of, you know, the shows around the country that you're doing and in Australia, that it is attracting all sorts of people. As you say, all cultures, all just everyone, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
It is a area that affects us all. And yeah, no one's no culture or no gender is safe, I believe.
Yeah, I totally agree. I say this, suicide does not discriminate.
Yeah.
Doesn't care. And that's why it takes a collective bunch of genuine people to help illuminate this from many different angles.
Yeah. I want to come back to a point that you talked at near the beginning around those sort of stable foundations. And, you know, you were talking about how you didn't have it because of, you know, moving with your dad being in the army. And I think, you know, that's absolutely key, and not necessarily does it need to replicate that during childhood, but certainly people that I work with, it's unstable foundations for some reason, you know, whether it is through financial stuff, whether it's through through past traumas, whether it's career stuff, or actually simply not knowing who they are. And, you know, we can get so caught up in trying to be in society's boxes and fit in and belong, as you talked about at school, that actually when we can get clear on who we are as a person and how we want to show up and potentially know what our place is on the planet, and we have that chance to actually secure and stabilize some of those foundations, then, you know, we do feel that maybe we have got sort of more understanding or more awareness of what's going on that can help that. I think you called it a rabbit warren. I call it a spiral, that we can actually start getting some understanding around what's going on. Because I certainly know through my journey of depression, I wouldn't know what was going on, you know. And I remember being at a point of just going, well, maybe I'm just broken and I've just got to get used to life like this. And it wasn't till shortly after that I again started more on my journey of self-awareness and the bits of the puzzle and things that it started to make sense. So what would you say to someone that, you know, maybe isn't even at the stage of wanting to end their life, but just don't know where they fit in, or sort of maybe what they're doing here hasn't got any direction or clarity? Any sort of tips for someone in that place?
Yeah, I just talk to them like I'd want to be talked to. You are loved. You're worth it. You are good enough. And don't listen to that voice. Because it takes a lot of practice to change that narrative, that silent one it's not silent to you, but it's no one else can hear it.
Yeah.
It takes a while to change that narrative and practice. I remember a very good friend of mine when I was in hospital recovering, and she saw like the mess, physical mess I was in, let alone the mental mess. And she said, imagine, Rob, if you focused as much on the light and the positivity as much as you did on the dark side, imagine what you could achieve. And I just went, wow, it's literally blowing my mind. My guts are cut wide open. I was like, wow, yeah. And she didn't even know about the negative voice that I had for many years. So she was just observing this and watching me. So it takes a lot of practice. And also, people are pretending a lot in their circle of friends. And I go, are they a circle of friends or you're in a cage? So just to really clarify what foundations you're building your life upon, and it's okay to change direction for a better you. It's okay. Sometimes you have to distance yourself from friends, even family members, just to establish a firmer, healthier foundation.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. And often on the journey, you know, we can find that some people will step up with us, and other friendships or connections may well fall away. I know when I gave up drinking nearly 2 years ago, that was a very interesting time as to, you know, sort of who stuck around and what people's reactions and responses were. And I remember one time being uninvited to something because I said, I'd love to come, but just so you know, I'm newly not drinking. And she was like, oh, maybe it's better you don't come.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. And it's like, actually, I'm just going to choose, you know, be aware of my journey and the people around me, because it is, you know, we can so easily take on other or get distracted or take on other people's views or opinions. But I think, you know, that journey back to ourselves and, yeah, being conscious of who's around us, what we're doing, what we're thinking, all that stuff that we're taking in. Yeah, massive, massive part of our journey and mental health, absolutely.
Yeah.
So do you find, or did you find that some people, yeah, sort of did step up and support you on this, and others, you know, were sort of conscious decisions to move away from?
I tell you what, there's nothing like a public mental breakdown being shot by the police to make people run for the hills. And some people, I thought my friends ran for the hills.
Ooh.
And others stood up and went, we're not going anywhere. So it sort of cleared the decks. And when I look back on it, I realize I was having unhealthy social relationships, not all the time, but certain people when I was feeling unhealthy. So I just gravitate towards them and go, oh yeah, that's right. Let's just drown it in whatever we can drown it in. So yeah. All of that, yeah.
I think that friggin' comfort zone, which is actually bloody uncomfortable sometimes, you know, but we know what it feels like. We know how people treat us in that place. We know, how people will respond to us. And however hard it is and however dark it is, we know what it's like, and it sort of can feel safe in some ways. And actually, however much we want to move towards the lighter times or whatever it is, however you want to call it, or connect back to us or make some changes, there's such a pull back to what we know. And, you know, again, I work with people and it's like, but Liz, I want that, but it feels friggin' scary right now. And it will, but you know, when we can go on that journey, whether it's, you know, with a therapist or whether it's with a buddy or a coach or a family member or a partner, and break it down into some of those tiny steps, or, you know, when we actually find that we're laughing again, and people, you know, again, I work with people and it's like, I can't remember the last time I had that really good belly laugh, you know, or we actually start to feel a sense of achievement or, you know, some self-worth. However small those little glimpses are, it's like, yeah, hold on to them, hold on to that memory and that feeling. Yeah. And yeah, let's work to getting that happening a bit more often. So you talked about, sort of therapists. What would be some of the things that you'd or recommend or that have worked for you to get to where you're at?
And the main tool is, or we've all got it, is we have the ability to speak up about what's happening inside of us. But you've got to find that safe space and those safe people. And we've all got to, I say this all the time because I believe it to be true, is the moment someone is listened to without judgment is the moment they begin to heal. So it's lifting off like a cloak of shame and to be able to breathe and go, thank goodness, you know, that's why people go to therapists and that's why people start turning up to ShopBro, my show/seminar, is because there's a forum afterwards, and the way that it is framed, it's a debrief. And then we share cups of tea and food just to keep grounding. So, yeah, just finding those safe places to express that with people who care about us. And people think, well, I can't tell my mates. And I'm like, well, are they really your mates? That's a big, challenging question.
And so if that was the case, and before people start having sort of new people coming into their life, what would you recommend? Helplines and reaching out to anyone?
Yeah, reach out to anyone who will listen. And this is what happened to me when I started speaking up about my mental health, is some people would tell me to shut up, because, and males, like, we don't want to hear about that shit. And I was like, oh, have I done something wrong? And I realized, someone, actually a friend, told me, you know what, you being in their presence is confronting, and you speaking about mental health, because they're hiding from their own stuff.
Just like John Kermit did for you.
Yeah, when John Kermit was on the air and me going, shut up, John.
Yeah.
All of that. So once I found out that, I realized that, oh, cool, you're not ready. And in my mind, you're scared. Sweet ass, next person. Oh, you're ready. Oh, you're scared too. And it's just to realize that. Otherwise, you take offense, and you just keep shutting down.
Yeah.
And you don't want, well, no one's going to listen. No one ever wants to listen. And you create that myth because of your experiences.
Absolutely. But
I just go, reach out anywhere. We've got so many helplines, 1737 trained counsellors. I'm not saying it's the be all and end all, but we've got so many things out there. I've heard people say, there's nothing. I went, whoa, where are you looking?
Yeah.
Because I remember that I used to be them, that there was no hope. And now I'm like, have you tried that? And they're like, send me three links. I'll try these first three. If they don't work, try these links.
Absolutely.
It's just finding what resonates with you.
Yeah. And I am going to give a mention to the Taranaki retreat at this point.
Yes.
Which is obviously so close to my heart. And again, you know, a very simple inquiry form on the website or, you know, ways to get in touch. And people can get in touch on other people's behalfs to begin with, you know, so if they are worried about someone, absolutely. Just get that ball rolling in some which way. Rob, I imagine it's a unique thing that after someone has been through what you've been through and or similar, that they decide to write a play about it. So are you able to share what... how that even came about? I know you've obviously got an acting background and playwriting background. How did the two sort of come together? Was it a light bulb moment or through a conversation, or how did it end up?
I was writing in hospital trying to figure out just screeds and screeds of writing. Oh, what's wrong with me? Why is this happening? Why am I in pain? Why is this? Why is that? How's this? This is terrible. And then friends who are poets like, man, that's taking a lot of time. Why don't you just write some short 5 lines of just pure emotion? I was like, I tried that as well when I was writing stories. I was just trying to get it out of me. Mm. So I had a lot of writings piled up over a long time. And then I applied to the Mental Health Foundation to get some funding for a first draft. And it was a bit of a rant and it was a bit all over the place. And it wasn't as clear as what it is today, but that just takes time.
Yeah.
So a friend said, if you weren't an actor or writer, do you think you made something like this? And I went, no.
Oh.
Because that wouldn't have been my norm. No. That's not the world that I know. And I remember I used to work as a fishmonger. I used to work for a fish company and factory in Sydney. And I used to drive past this sign that said acting classes every 7 p.m. And I wanted to go every time. But I'm like in a van full of fish smells. I was like fish guy, and I went, they won't accept someone like me. I'm never going to go. I was just trying to look for an outlet that I could express myself. Yeah.
And so how did you get, I need to know now, how did you get into acting?
Well, I'm going to tell you something which I do share in some of my forums, depends if someone asks, is when I was 21, I tried to take my life 3 times.
Okay.
Yeah, I've been freaking my family out for a long time. And so saw a shrink then, and then I just thought, what do I want to do? They're trying to, because the parents are freaking out, they want you to have a purpose. Like we all need one. And they were suggesting things that weren't appealing to me. And I saw a drama school in Whangarei at Northland Polytechnic. And I went, wow, that looks amazing. That's in Whangarei, where some of our family live, where I was based in Auckland.
Okay.
And so I went and sussed out a class, and then auditioned in the roughness of what I was back in the day, and I got in, and it just became an outlet. I found like I had discovered my tribe.
Nice.
My tribe of weirdos.
Awesome. And I think that's such a key point, isn't it, really, that we have touched on about finding that tribe and people around you and finding your thing, you know, whatever that is, and it doesn't need to be through, a job or career. Finding our passion and the things that really light us up can be in any parts of life, you know, might be having children, it might be a hobby or passion or interest. But again, those things that remind us what life is all about.
Absolutely.
So, shot bro.
Cracks me up every time someone says it. I'm like, because it's funny, dark, real for me.
Yeah, absolutely. It really is. And I don't feel many people would be able to bring humour into such a subject as well as you do, you know. And I feel I want to see it again, see your show again to, you know, now that I know so much more about your journey and you and obviously my learnings and things, and I think it will, yeah, make, you know, I'll be able to get even more from it. Absolutely.
Well, I just also, if it wasn't for my really good friends in the theatre community who just kept rallying next to me and around me and said, I heard you're trying to tell your story. And they helped me with workshops. And my friend Edna Daniels, a friend, and she's a actor, writer, director. So many people wanted to direct it, but I thought, you can't be as crazy as me. You actually have to be less crazy. And my very good friend, Edna Daniels, I saw her work and I trusted. I went, can you help me unpack this? So the safe person, she read it. She didn't understand what that was, what this is, maybe this. And for the first time, you have somebody who's making you feel safe. Mm. And you have to find the words. What you thought was obvious is not obvious to someone else.
Right.
That's what came up. Because to me, I was like, can you not see this is like brain as? And she's like, I have no idea what you mean by that. So it was great to have somebody like that to help me unpack.
Awesome. And as you mentioned, it is left field. Are there any sort of really random places that you've taken it to? Do you want to share some of the different experiences around that?
I've done it, and I've done Shopbro in a boxing ring.
Okay.
At Nelson, at Victory Boxing Gym in Nelson, did 3 presentations, took down those ropes, and all the community came. That was pretty cool. Felt very much like Rocky, Rocky films. Done it in art galleries, but also I've done it in prisons, maximum security units. I've been in big spaces and small spaces in prison, and that's very intense. The smaller the venue, because it's very close proximity.
Mm-hmm.
So that's quite intense. Outdoors, I've done some outdoors.
Nice. But
basically, it's spaces where communities feel safe to congregate.
Okay, yeah. And before the show, we were talking about, are you also taking it into sort of corporate settings as well now?
I have organisations. So yeah, I've done presentations, not the show, but just 1-hour presentation for 2 Degrees Telecommunications.
Okay.
And I'd never done that before, and I thought, maybe try it, because for me, speaking is not as effective as watching the full Shopbro experience, because I've got something to judge it from. But doing that, and also I've been on multiple New Zealand military bases presenting my show seminar, and I'm in the forum with their in-house therapists, so we're all sharing and learning at the same time.
Wow, yeah, that would be incredibly powerful.
It just creates that safe space that. And you can see where systems are failing.
Yeah.
And we're only humans. Humans are only trying their best within a system that is not fully connecting to their people.
Yeah. And one thing I love about life is the ripple effect. And from your documentary, I think a lady came up to your Whangarei show, and then you went and did a show to remember her son who took his life. And I know that our mutual friend Annie saw your show and then organized for, I think, a few around the East Coast, East Cape maybe. Are you aware of any other ripple effects from your show?
Yeah, I get told firsthand that I help somebody.
Yeah.
Quite a lot. If they can't speak to me at the time, then they email me.
Okay.
Or message me. There was a group in a community in Foxton when I presented 2-3 years ago. They had nothing other than a community safe talk group, and they're all down suicide training. So they're being the change in the community. They're not waiting for it.
Nice.
They created it. And they did it. I didn't do anything. But when you hear of communities just going, okay, well, let's not wait for the government. Let's just create the change ourselves in a positive way. I get to meet these people all around New Zealand and parts of Australia. It's so inspiring because we're all from a lived experience and upgrading our skills and our knowledge to help others as well as ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's essential. I think, you know, that sort of proactive approach, it's got to be where it's at. We can't be waiting for governments or whatever else to come on board. So that's awesome to hear. Yeah, communities getting you in and getting that understanding and to have that space for questions and stuff afterwards. That's just gold.
It is gold, and it's really humbling because along my learning and reading and watching documentaries or hearing people speak, meeting the real people on the ground, especially parents who've lost their kids, it's actually altered the way I look at helping people with bereavement. There's prevention, and then there's bereavement, which is part of that, and it's a different way. It's way more different than I thought when I was marching into my talk. I've had to evolve.
Okay.
And I have to evolve and go, oh shit, this, what I heard from so-and-so is actually, they're not from a lived experience. These parents have lost, and these are the real tools that they need. So I shut up and listen. That's what I'm trying to say. Yeah. Still learning.
Yeah, absolutely. Because from my understanding, grief and bereavement is one thing, and then grief and bereavement of somebody who has taken their life is actually a whole nother minefield, maybe.
Yeah, it is a minefield. And when someone has taken their lives, and I've been to a few funerals, unfortunately, somebody needs to stand up and go, hey, if you're feeling these words of suicide ideation here at this service, there's a safe space. We're all going to go over there, and here's some tools or pamphlets. That's what I reckon, because I've been to one recently, and I was thinking, because I'm an extended family member, should I say something? I was like, shut up, Rob, let these people grieve. But I spoke to a few people afterwards who knew me, and were like, man, what do you think of that? And I went, I wish somebody said, hey, if you're hurting right now, there's a place we can go and talk at safely. And here's some resources to take home.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because again, not going into the statistics, but I think the chances of someone taking their life are so much higher if they've already lost somebody close to them or within the family. That would be the time to let people know that there's help there.
It takes a break because it's something so new. Like when you're dealing with something as painful as a suicide from a family or loved one, if that's not your world, you've got no tools.
Yeah.
And I'm not judging or saying you should do it this way. Let's just consider it.
Yeah. And I think it's it's about options, isn't it? That, you know, people can start to feel that they have got options or places to go to or people to listen. That must be a starting point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Rob, what would be one thing that you wish everybody knew?
That they're goddamn worth it. I want everybody to know you're goddamn worth it, and I want you to hang out with people that think you are the bee's knees and just practice that. And it's hard to look in the mirror and go, I've done a good job today. And I chatted to people on the Sky. Friend, mentor George Davis worked for Ngāti Raukawa Whānau Order in around the Horo Whenua, so that's Laverne, Otaki, Fielding. And he said he was working with youth and teaching them that. Just pat yourself on the shoulder. And small victories. Yeah. We're always waiting to climb the mountain of the greatest mountain before we even give ourselves a little bit of praise. Yeah. Little victories about, hey, I got out of bed today when I didn't want to get out for a week. I got the kids to and from school alive. Yay! Yeah. I had a wash when I didn't want to wash.
Yeah.
And when you simplify these little small victories, it's a lot easier than waiting for the main gold-winning moment in the Olympics, which may not come, or maybe you've set the bar so high that you're going to beat yourself up every day quietly.
Yeah, such a good point. I made such a thing of congratulating myself for putting out the washing the other day.
Yes, yes, do that.
Because, you know, if it turned into a beautiful day, if it had been, you know, if I hadn't put it out, I'd have berated myself and I was like, oh, I should have put it out. Why didn't I get up earlier and do it? Blah, blah, blah. I would have gone on probably. But yeah, I was like, I friggin' did it and it's going to be dry when I get home.
Yeah, I physically do that sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, nice. I love that. Love it, love it. Okay, Rob, maybe to finish off, are you able to share how people can follow you, how they can get to your show, how they can get your show to them? What's next for you?
I've got a Facebook page, which is Shopbro Confessions of a Depressed Bullet. I've just got a one-page website now, which can click onto links. It's toiturama.nz. And toi meaning creative, and turama meaning to illuminate.
Okay.
Basically, creative illumination for this, the frame and the vehicle that I'm using. But you can also email me at rob@toiturama.nz. toiturama. toiturama.nz. And people, message me via the page or email me.
Awesome. Anything else that you want to add finally, Rob, before we finish off?
I'd love to come and visit the retreat. Love to meet you face to face. And just experience the beauty of your retreat, from what I've heard from very close friends of mine.
Awesome. Yeah, we'll certainly make that happen. And I will just give it another shout out. So that's taranakiretreat.org.nz. And yeah, we take people from all over the country. So it's certainly not just a local thing. So yeah, have a look, see if it's a fit. There's different resources and things on there. So yes, do have a look. And it is, you walk through the gate and it's just a bubble of love and support. It's really quite incredible and unique. Thank you, Rob. Thank you so much for your time. And yeah, let's make it happen in person and let's stay in touch.
Hey, thank you so much for like messaging me and having this platform to help others, because, you know, it takes so many of us just to try and illuminate this, and it's a collective effort. So I really appreciate you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of Around the Fire. I hope you've enjoyed it. I hope you've gleaned some ideas or some information, some thoughts, or maybe even feeling a bit inspired right now. I love getting feedback, so do contact me via my website, liz-fry.com, if you'd like to share some thoughts, or if you're feeling that actually maybe you'd like to share your story. Maybe that you think, okay, yeah, it's time that I want to get my story out there, then I would absolutely love to have that conversation, and I'd love to have you on the podcast. Do get in touch and we'll start to make that happen. The music that you've been hearing throughout this episode was created specifically for the podcast by an amazing man called Jake Keanu Skinner. You'll find Jake on Facebook and Instagram under Theta Soundscapes by Jake. And I would ask you to go and have a bit of a explore and listen to some other tracks that he does. He plays an incredible amount of instruments and weaves them together in ways that I've never heard anywhere else. So do go and explore that afterwards. But for now, I would ask that you just take the last couple of minutes of this podcast to listen to the music, imagine the embers of the fire in front of you, and just take some time to be still and take some time for you. Thank you.